On the evening of May 22, 2010, in the city of Costa Mesa, California, a dramatic 911 call was received by the Costa Mesa Police Department.
Okay, what's going on, sir?
There's a body in my son's apartment.
There's a what?
A body. A dead body.
A dead body? Are you sure, sir?
I can think it's so, man. I'm sure.
Okay.
She's cold.
Okay, hold on just a minute. Is it someone that you know, sir?
I have no idea who she is. But, I don't know what's going on.
Does your son know who it is?
He's not here. Jesus, honey.
Okay. Do you know where your son is?
No, I don't. I told you. So far.
Okay. Just keep breathing for me, sir, okay? Where in the apartment is she?
She's in the bedroom. She's with some sexual activity. She's dead. There's blood from her head. I thought she was to see if she was cold.
There was blood from her head?
Yeah. Honey, I don't know what to say.
Okay, just stay in there, okay?
I see her. She's dead. Jesus Christ.
It is, but is it clear it is?
The victim that is being described to dispatch is 23-year-old Julie Kibuishi. Her body had just been discovered, lying next to a bed surrounded in a pool of her own blood.
Hello?
I'm still here, sir. I'm not going to hang up, okay? Until there's someone there with you. Is anybody else in the apartment besides you?
Oh, no.
No one else is in there?
Yeah, there's somebody there. Okay. Who are you?
Sir, who are you talking to now?
Jake, I'm telling you. Just go. I don't know. Just go. I got the cops coming. Go.
Who is that you're talking to?
One of his friends.
One of your son's friends?
No.
Has Jake talked to your son today?
No. I don't need you on the line, okay? I don't need you on the line. I'm good.
The man whose voice you have been listening to belongs to Steve Hare. Steve's son, Sam, lived in that apartment but had planned to stay at his parents' house over the weekend. As Friday came and went, Sam was nowhere in sight. It was also quite strange that his phone was turned off. His parents were starting to worry, so on the next afternoon, Steve decided to go check on him, only to find the lifeless body of Julie. Police arrived on the scene, and their investigation immediately began. Besides some empty beer bottles on his porch table, the rest of the apartment was relatively clean. There was a wedding invitation on the kitchen countertop from a couple that Sam must have been friends with, Dan Wozniak and Rachel Buffett. Police noted to investigate this couple at a later time. For now, they moved on to the bedroom where the crime had taken place. To the right of the bed was a small tactical knife sitting on the bedside table. Amongst other items, there were several books, one of which was a soldier's handbook, a guide to military values and skills. To the left of the bed is where they found Julie. She was lying partially on the bed in a praying position with her knees on the floor. A message was marked on the back of her shirt that said, "All yours, fuck you." There was a large open wound to the back of her head, but untouched sitting on top of her head was a tiara. She had met up with her brother Taka and his fiance for dinner at a local Thai food restaurant the night before. They had asked her to be a part of their upcoming wedding and gave her said tiara as a gift. While they were investigating the apartment, they began to hear a muffled Taylor Swift song coming from somewhere in the room. They followed the noise and they discovered Julie's cell phone with notifications available to read on the lock screen. They then sifted through these messages. They found out that on the night before, Sam had sent her a multitude of messages. These messages started off normal, with a text saying, "Helping Dan," then headed to the folks for the weekend. However, a couple of hours later, his tone shifted to a more perturbing one. "Can you come over tonight at midnight alone? Very upset. Need to talk. I'm dealing with some bad family crap. I don't want to be alone. Please don't tell anybody. Please. Please. No sex. I just need to talk." Julie then responded with, "I'm here for you like family." Investigators wanted to know more about Sam before they jumped to any conclusions. As it turns out, Sam was actually an army veteran who had served time in Afghanistan. He was deployed to one of the most dangerous territories, stationed at Camp Keating. However, being a war hero often comes at a toll. His friends said that he was showing signs of PTSD when he came home. Sam and Julie had recently started dating shortly after Julie began tutoring him for an anthropology course. That explained why Julie was in Sam's apartment in the first place. However, detectives felt that the most important detail about Sam was that Sam was charged and tried for murder once before. He was accused of luring his friend into an area where gang members then shot him. But Sam was found not guilty and was acquitted on all charges. With this background information on Sam, investigators now had what seemed to be a cut-and-dry theory. Sam, who had been exposed to crime in the past, had been drinking and possibly using other drugs as well. He then had a psychotic episode as a result of his PTSD and proceeded to assault and kill Julie. He then fled the scene.
The victim was just 23 years old. Her boyfriend is now missing.
He hasn't been seen since last week. Neighbors say his bicycle sits outside his apartment, but his vehicle is gone.
Now, Costa Mesa police have released a photo and vehicle description, hoping to locate a 26-year-old man suspected of killing his 23-year-old girlfriend.
Police issued a photo of Sam and a description of his car. They told the public that he was potentially dangerous and to call 911 if they had any information on his whereabouts. Sam remained MIA for over a week. Meanwhile, police continued to question everybody involved in Sam and Julie's life, including Dan Wozniak and Rachel Buffett, the engaged couple whose wedding invitation was found on Sam's kitchen countertop. Police knew that Sam had been with Dan just hours before Julie's murder after finding messages on Julie's phone. Dan and Rachel both shared the same story with the detectives. On Friday, May 21st, Sam had arrived at their house accompanied by a man in a black hat. They all had a brief conversation, and then Sam and his friend left. That was it. That was their entire story. While working to corroborate this story, law enforcement was hitting dead end after dead end. However, Sam's dad, Steve, was doing his own investigation. He gained access to Sam's bank account and realized that there was account activity since he had gone missing, as somebody had withdrawn cash from the account 20 miles away in Long Beach. They tracked this activity to the specific ATM and were able to obtain footage from the exact time that Sam's card was being used. However, the person using the ATM wasn't Sam at all. It was a younger man, possibly a teenager. The card had also been used at a pizza place in Long Beach. The pizza place cooperated with law enforcement and provided the address that the order was sent to. Worried that a panicked and dangerous veteran may be there, police conducted a fully fleshed out raid on the pizza purchaser's home. A helicopter circled above the address while a SWAT team with their guns drawn approached and knocked on the door. 17-year-old Wesley Fralick answered, the same teenager seen in the ATM footage. Officers demanded Wesley come out of the house with his hands up. After the chaos settled, it became clear that Sam was not hiding at this teenager's home, so they asked Wesley how he got a hold of Sam's bank card. Wesley told the investigators that he was given the card by none other than Dan Wozniak. Apparently, Dan was his mentor in the acting business. He said that Dan told him that Sam was in trouble with a bail bondsman and needed help withdrawing money. He even had a folder outlining the legalities of what they were doing. Wesley trusted Dan, so he agreed to help. There was something that Wesley found odd. Dan stated that he needed to wear a black hat. He then began withdrawing $400 at a time and delivering the cash to Dan, which explained the recent bank activity. With this new information, the narrative quickly shifted to Dan being the prime suspect in both Julie's murder and Sam's disappearance. When they reached out to him and asked him to answer some questions at the police station, he told them that his wedding was in 2 days, and that he was too busy having a sushi dinner for his bachelor party. Officers then went to the sushi restaurant and confronted him. Dan reacted immediately by saying he was sick of covering for Sam, and that he would tell the police everything. So they brought him back to the station for questioning, and his fiancée Rachel followed once she received the news.
Fred, have a seat. Yes, sir.
I need to start from the beginning.
Yeah.
Friday morning, I woke up and got a nice call from Sam in the morning. He said, how serious are you about this? And at the time, I was in a little bit of money, so I said, very serious. It can't work. So I said, okay, what do we need to make it happen?
What Dan is talking about is a scheme that Sam had allegedly concocted. The plan was to get 17-year-old Wesley Frelick to withdraw cash from Sam's bank account, which Sam would then report as stolen. Once the bank reimbursed Sam for the stolen cash, they would then divide the cash up between the three of them. Dan then explained exactly how he instructed Wesley to pull it off.
I said, okay, Wes, here's what we're going to do. I treated like I was a co-op guy pretending to be an actor. So I said, here's what you need to do. You need to, I'm going to park across the street. And I parked. It was across the street from the bank, so I wouldn't be seen.
Okay.
I was avoiding. I said, what you're going to do is get out, grab your skateboard, go over there, enter the PIN number, take out $400.
Okay.
Because I heard it was the maximum you could take out. He said, okay. He asked if it was illegal. I said, no, don't worry. That was my idea, too.
After retrieving the money from the ATM, Dan dropped Wesley off at home and let him hold on to Sam's bank card. This scam initially took place on Friday afternoon, which was reflected through the bank card transactions. Julie's body was found the next day, on Saturday afternoon. The detectives needed to fill this gap in the timeline, so they asked Dan about the last time that he saw Sam, which was apparently Saturday morning.
I got a knock on my door. I want to say it was about 8:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Told him the door, it was Sam. He's like, there's a dead body in my apartment. He's like, okay. Basically, as soon as you left me, I started doing some drugs and drinking again because I was very depressed about it. I said, what did you do? He's like, I got a gun. He asked me for sex. He was pretty up. He said no, and then he just shot her twice.
Apparently, this is when Dan expressed that he did not want to be a part of Sam's predicament. Sam then threatened Dan and Rachel's life and forced Dan to drop him off somewhere. Supposedly, Dan then decided to drive him to the local mall. Now that Dan has admitted to being Sam's accomplice, with knowledge of Julie's murder and transporting the suspect, the detectives decided to collect his DNA in order to eliminate him from the crime scene.
What we're going to do is, this is a swab. I guess swab for okay. To eliminate you. Should we take a sec?
Oh, eliminate me?
Yeah, eliminate you from any issues. So basically, just open your mouth for me. That's it.
Oh, okay.
Basically, you know, where it is, it's just an elimination process. You're not in trouble with us, you've been honest. There should be no reason why we should find your DNA anywhere.
At this moment, Dan likely realizes that the information he has withheld from the detectives would incriminate him if they find his DNA in Sam's apartment. He decides to quickly explain that he was, in fact, in Sam's apartment that Friday, and outlines exactly where his DNA might be found.
Now, I was in Sam's apartment Friday afternoon.
Okay.
And I know I did use the bathroom.
You did use the bathroom?
I used the bathroom, and I went... I'm not sure if I went out on the patio or not. Most of the time I do, but that day I don't know if I did or not.
Okay. We got your DNA?
Yes.
Okay. Where's that DNA going to show up?
In Sam's car.
What about on Julie?
No, on Julie.
You sure about that?
Yes, I'm positive about that.
Did you see Julie dead in the apartment?
No, I did not.
I think you know a little more about this thing than you're divulging to us.
Oh, I don't.
I think there's a whole lot more.
There may be, but please question me on any gaps that I want to fill. Absolutely.
As far as your participation in this thing?
As far as my participation?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I helped him get away. Yes, I knew that he had killed someone, and yes, I knew that I...
Stop right there.
Stop. So I'm staying
here. Absolutely. Yeah. You're arrested.
For her?
Okay, accessory to murder. That's what you're being arrested for. You don't want to talk to us anymore? That's
okay,
it?
Okay,
yeah, we're done.
Hold on.
Whoa. Okay. We're done. Unless you want to talk to us, we're done.
I will talk to you about anything if it gets me to my wedding on Friday. That's what I will promise. Anything you want.
Go ahead, listen to me.
Yes, I helped Sam get away. Yes, I did not know what he was planning until then. Yes, I lied to you guys earlier. Yes, I did stuff that I'm not proud of. That's it.
Dan, you got the answers. You can help us.
I don't know what else you want me to say.
I don't know.
Tell us the truth.
He came down and said, help me. I went upstairs, and yes, I saw the goddamn body.
Is that what you want to hear?
No. We want to hear the truth.
That is the truth.
If this was an audition for the role of an innocent man, Dan just blew it. Dan has now admitted to helping a killer get away, seeing Julie's dead body in the apartment, and then doing nothing about it. The detectives now lie to Dan, stating that his DNA was found on Julie's body. They do this with the hopes that he will give up more incriminating information.
How'd your DNA get on her?
Because I was right over the body.
What's that?
Because I was right over the body.
Okay. So how'd your DNA get on her?
That I don't know.
DNA doesn't just fall off.
I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't touch her. I didn't do anything.
What did you see?
I saw two gunshots in her head. And I saw her pants, like, ripped and cut. And I saw, like, you written on the back of the shirt.
Where were the two bullet wounds?
I don't know. Sam said he shot her twice.
Okay.
And but I didn't see.
You just told us you saw two bullet wounds. You were standing over.
No. Okay.
Whoa. Stop.
Okay.
How did your DNA get on? I was standing over the body. I saw two bullet wounds to her head.
Thank you, Cindy.
You can't even keep your lies straight.
The reason the detectives are drilling Dan for the two bullet hole statement is because they have already seen Julie's gunshot wounds and are aware that Dan's claim to have seen two bullet holes is unrealistic. The wounds to Julie's head were nothing short of gruesome, and clearly distinguishing two separate bullet holes through the mess of hair, blood, and brain matter was impossible without further examination. There are only two people who would know such a fact after a first encounter: the coroner slash forensic pathologist and the person who pulled the trigger.
You're done?
Instead of escorting Dan to a holding cell, they brought in Rachel to ask him questions herself.
You can go over and sit right there.
So when was the last time you really saw Sam? What happened? There's nothing he can do at this point to
make
it better.
Absolutely. He can be truthful with us and truthful with you and truthful with everyone.
The questioning wasn't going anywhere, so they decided to bring Rachel into another room and question her on her own. She explained that Dan had borrowed money from loan sharks in order to pay their rent, and he would be in danger if he didn't pay them back. Apparently, on the day that Dan was expected to pay the money back, Sam stopped by in the morning and the two went for a drive. Dan ended up returning alone with $400.
He told me the people were going to come break his legs, and he was scared out of his mind. He came down to the apartment because he was going to give Dan a ride. He had $400 somehow on Friday.
After this interview, Rachel was free to go, and Dan was escorted back to a holding cell. Later that evening, Dan placed a call to Rachel from the police department. This is that phone call.
What did you do?
I helped Sam cover some stuff up and helped him get some drugs. That's it. I didn't murder anybody.
My mom's working on canceling all the wedding plans now, and I just talked to Tim, and I need to make a phone call to the detective now. Tim says he has evidence with him, or he knew where it was or something.
Then I'm doomed.
Do you know that Tim had some evidence?
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God.
The evidence that they are referring to is a backpack full of Sam's bloody clothes, his wallet, and his phone. Dan gave this bag to his brother, Tim, so he could dispose of it and prevent the cops from getting their hands on it. Police later found this bag thrown over Tim's fence as a last-ditch effort to quickly hide the evidence.
This is ridiculous, and I have to go tell the detective the truth.
No, baby, no, don't, that can't be found. Babe, listen to me. I'm going to go do something right now, and you're not going to see me for the rest of your life. Do you understand that?
No.
I have to tell the truth on what I did, and I think you now know what it is, and it's bad. Imagine the worst, and that's what I did.
I love you, baby. I'll be right there. Okay.
Following through with his word, Dan requested to speak with the detectives once again.
Okay. Talk to us. What do you have to tell me? You said you wanted to talk to me. What's going on?
I'm crazy and I did it.
You did what?
I killed Julie and I killed Sam.
Okay. All right.
I killed them both.
All right.
Sam came first. It was all just about the money. That was it. All
right.
100%. Sam is decapitated.
Okay.
He's at the military base.
All right.
In the theater.
His head and hands have been decapitated, as well as his arm that had a tattoo.
What was going on in your mind when you were dismembering the body, dismembering Sam's body?
I was actually smiling and laughing.
Possibly the most disturbing aspect of this confession is that just hours after murdering and dismembering Sam, Dan performed as usual, dancing and singing in a theater musical called Nine.
Top of the morning to you, Guido, 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 me, and you will be my true love.
Backstage, while the play was still ongoing, Dan texted Julie using Sam's phone to lure her to the apartment later that evening. He says he then staged the scene to frame Sam. The next day, he disposed of Sam's body and proceeded to give another performance.
See what I mean?
Now satisfied with the confession Dan has provided, the detectives wanted to understand his motive for killing Sam.
And your motive behind killing Sam was...
Money and insanity.
Money and insanity. Okay.
Directly following this interrogation, Dan was charged with two counts of first-degree murder. Despite his clear-as-day confession, he would later plead not guilty to his charges. Dan called Rachel once more to tell her what he had just told the detectives.
I shot him two times in the back of the head. And then I grabbed his credit cards and I grabbed Wesley and we took money out of his account. I opened up the door of Sam's apartment and shot her twice in the back of the head.
So how did nobody hear the gun?
I don't know. I got lucky.
Why did I do it? Why?
I love you, baby. You are so insane and so stupid. But I know in your twisted little mind, you were doing it. Because you wanted to be happy with me. And I hate you for screwing it up.
Shortly after the details of the killing went public, a man contacted the police with another story. The man's name was Chris Williams, and he was another struggling performer. He said that he was friends with Dan and Rachel, and he was actually the one who had lent them the loan shark money that Dan needed to pay back. Apparently, Chris had provided Rachel and Dan $2,000 of his own money. He then told them that it was from dangerous people to help guarantee that he would be paid back. This means that on the day of the murder, Dan did not owe any leg-breaking loan sharks money. He actually owed Chris. It also turns out that on that day, Chris attempted to retrieve his money at the same time that Sam had arrived at their apartment, and he witnessed Dan leave with Sam. Then, 3 hours later, return home without him. He says that Dan was essentially in a full-blown panic attack, and he smacked down $400 on the table. Rachel was visibly angry. A week later, while preparing for Dan and Rachel's wedding, he was informed about the murders. He made the connection that they occurred on the same day as his peculiar encounter with them, so he dialed 911 immediately. This story introduced more suspicion onto Rachel. A credible witness is now saying that she knew about the loan all along, while she is claiming that Dan was solely responsible for it. So the detectives brought Rachel back in for another interview.
Why don't you tell me why you forgot to tell me about this?
Because honestly, I was afraid that if you knew that Chris had seen us that day, I don't know who Chris knows, and I don't know if he knows anybody bad.
You don't think we were going to find out?
They'll come to me.
Did you think we were not going to find out?
I guess not. I don't know. I'm a little bit afraid.
Well, I can tell you.
The detectives did not believe Rachel, so they had her wear a voice stress analyzer, a lie detection device that aims to differentiate between stressed and non-stressed outputs in a response to stimuli. The National Institute of Justice says the chance of detecting deception is about 50% with these devices. However, they also say that the subjects may be deterred from lying if they think their responses can be proven false.
Did you plan the murder with Dan?
I'm trying to remember everything I can. I've told you guys everything I know. I'm completely innocent.
He's gone for 3 hours and he comes back having a heart attack. Yeah. We know he's out killing Sam at that point.
I thought he was just overreacting because he thought he was afraid of loan sharks and getting hurt. I'm sorry that I'm not the kind of person who just goes berserk and loses their mind when they hear this. I just sit there in shock and soak it in.
You weren't in shock.
Rachel stuck to her story, and there wasn't any physical evidence to tie her to the murders, so the detectives had no choice but to let her go for now. With Dan in jail and Rachel continuing to profess her innocence, the detectives worked with the district attorney to begin building their case. After 2 years into the investigation, they finally made the decision to arrest and charge Rachel for being an accessory to murder after the fact. Basically, the only crime they could feasibly arrest her for was lying about two things: her dealings with Chris, who was at the apartment the day of the murders, and the fabricated man in the black hat, who wasn't at the apartment at all. Rachel ended up pleading not guilty, and even held a press conference after posting her bail.
Are you saying you're innocent? What are you saying?
Completely innocent.
She quickly capitalized on the limelight while she was out on bail, participating in several interviews with news stations and even Dr. Phil.
Did you know that he had any involvement in these murders at all?
Not until after the police did.
I was aghast when I get a call saying you're going on TV. That offends me.
I understand, and maybe I made a bad judgment call by coming on here, but I didn't come out when everything first happened and said, oh, look at this horrible situation, I'm the victim. You didn't see me selling my story to Hollywood to make a movie.
Not yet.
Rachel wasn't the only one taking advantage of the spotlight. While in jail awaiting his trial, Dan took part in an episode of MSNBC's Lockup, where he seems to recant his confessions.
I want people to know that I'm a good guy. I enjoy long walks on the beach. I'm an Aries.
Dan began his turn in court. Orange County Senior Deputy District Attorney Matt Murphy urged jurors to impose the death penalty for Dan.
How many layers of awful do we need before the death penalty is appropriate? Before the death penalty is the only possible way we can satisfy justice in a case. He did not care about those people. And now I'm asking you to care about those people. Through your verdict, I'm asking you, you set this right. You take care of business when you go back there. You take care of business. Thank you.
In response to the prosecution, Dan's defense team said it was really Rachel who had manipulated him into committing these atrocious acts, and therefore, Dan should not be met with the death penalty. On January 11th, 2016, after less than an hour of deliberation, a jury recommended the death penalty for 32-year-old Daniel Patrick Wozniak.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Daniel Patrick Wozniak, guilty of the crime of murder in the first degree.
It is death for a double murderer who needed money for his wedding and tried to frame one of his victims for his deadly deed. As CBS 2 Orange County reporter Michelle Gili shows us, the victim's family members had a lot to say to the killer.
It is the order of this court that you shall suffer the death penalty.
Convicted Orange County killer Daniel Wozniak, a community theater actor before his capture, has been sentenced to death for his real-life role as the mastermind in a gruesome double murder.
You, Dan, are a coward and a poster boy for the need of the effective death penalty in California. My only regret that in this state won't let me kill this coward myself. Thank you.
You took her precious life. And then you disgraced her. How could you do anything like that to my baby?
Dan was sentenced to death, but is currently residing at the Salinas Valley State Prison. As for Rachel, she went to trial in September of 2018, and her defense attorney tried their best to explain the flaws in her timelines and details. After 5 hours, the jury came back with a verdict.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled action, find the defendant, Rachel Mae Buffett, guilty.
In the end, Rachel Buffett was sentenced to 32 months in prison, and around 5 of those months were shaved off due to time served while awaiting trial. She was then released in 2019. Also in 2019, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a moratorium on the death penalty in California, which means that Daniel Wozniak is not allowed to be killed via lethal injection as previously planned.
I have always wanted to express my condolences to the Hare and Kibuishi families and offer support, but I assume that any contact from me, a complete stranger before this case, would not be welcomed or helpful, so I sought to be respectful by giving them space. I hope my silence has not been misinterpreted as callous. I'm also so sorry that any of my actions caused more pain to the Hare and Kibuishi families. I wish Sam and Julie were still here. I wish I could have done something to save them. I wish I never met Daniel Wozniak. I wish I never let him into my life. I wish I saw him for the liar and the manipulator he was from day one. And I wish there was something I could do to fix this now. My heart goes out to the Harankibi Wishi families.